What time frame was this? Would this have been the late 40s?
The plant started up in the late 40s. And DuPont also was starting up a titanium oxide plant via the chloride route at Edgemoor, Delaware. And we were having so doggone many problems, we had DuPont consultants galore. Well, those consultants were shuttling between the titanium tetrachloride process and our plant, and we got to know more doggone consultants, because both of them had serious problems. Matter of fact, the titanium dioxide plant was almost shut down. It was so corrosive. Mm. And the guy that kept it going was Crawford Greenewald. He kept saying, God, let's persist in that. It probably took about 3 years before they ever figured out how to make titanium dioxide via the chloride route rather than the sulfate route.
So did you stay with this plant till it was shut down?
No.
Or did you move on?
No, I moved on in 1954. I was named Assistant Director of Research of the Electrochemical Department, which was sort of a shock to me, because that was a move that moved me up about three levels. That was tended to be unprecedented in DuPont. But I enjoyed research, and I had a lot of fun at it. Matter of fact, I was reminded the other night when this gal was talking about recruiting, that one of the things I had to do in the early 50s was recruit PhD chemists and engineers, mostly PhD chemists, because there weren't too many engineers with. And I developed a route for explaining to these guys that I was trying to recruit. And by the way, there was a competitive system inside of DuPont. In other words, a guy could interview with Elkem and Polychem, and then pick the, if he got offers from three or more departments, he could pick the one he wanted to go to. So your job was not only an internal job. And I'll never forget what I pointed out to these guys. I asked them how much they wanted to earn after they were out of school 10 years. And most of these guys said about $10,000 or $12,000 a year. I said, now what would you like to have? Well, I'd like to have a house on at the shore and a house on, blah, blah. I said, you're not going to be able to buy that for $10,000 or $12,000. And then I'd pull out an annual report. And in those days, the top tax bracket was 92% for people I can't recall. And I'd point out to them what you had to earn to get the things you wanted, which opened up the eyes to a hell of a lot of PhD, because they had never thought about it. Mm-hmm. They just hadn't thought about it. Had no reason to think about it. So I wound up getting more damn PhD chemists that year. Matter of fact, my boss, a guy named Dr. Austin, who was a friend of Speed Marvel's at Illinois. I'd say that didn't hurt me one iota in terms of making my next move, which was into sales, which I knew nothing about. I knew less about sales than I knew about research.
I was going to ask you about, do you know how this appointment came about? You said you jumped three levels. And that was unusual. Who singled you out to?
Well, that's a good question, and I really don't know the answer to that. But I was passed over twice to be the superintendent of the adiponitrile plant, and two more experienced guys were put in there ahead of me. And when I became, and then those guys moved on, and I became the superintendent. Well, what I think I did, I'm not sure of this, is I was willing to make promises that we could make material at a higher rate than my predecessors were, and we did it. I can't remember the number, but I think we promised that we could make 40 tank cars a month. And I'll never forget, I got a telegram from a guy in Wilmington that was assistant to the general manager at that time, who congratulated me on getting 40 cars. So a talk I've given many a times is that not enough people take risks, willing to take risks. The two guys before me were conservative. I was willing to say we could and mobilize the organization to get what seemed to be unattainable. And I think that probably helped me out. I don't really know that.
And who did you report to when you became the assistant director?
I reported to a guy named Paul Austin. He was the director of research.
Okay. This was still within the electrochemicals department?
Yeah, still in the electrochemicals department.
And what kind of responsibilities did you have during those 2 years before you moved into sales?
Well, one of the things I learned a hell of a lot about was patents, because the guy who headed up patents reported to me. I had all of them. The research department at that time, God, probably had 200 or 300 people in it. About a third of them were in pilot plants. I was responsible for that. And the DuPont system in those days gave the assistant practically all the day-to-day authority. It was a system for training guys. So you got a lot of responsibility that you wouldn't ordinarily get in other companies. Matter of fact, I tried to sell the companies I was with subsequently to use a DuPont system, and I failed miserably because they said that's too expensive. But it was a hell of a way of training people to do a job. So I ran the staff meeting as assistant director of research, and the director of research sat by. And so you learned a lot, a hell of a lot.
You said that there was a high-level employee relations group that tracked the experience of the managers.
And as far as I know, they still do. And that was... it was an interesting project. You'd be interviewed about once a year about what you were going to do with these people that apparently were ready to move. And then these guys would write that down and then come back to you 6 months or a year later. What have you done with so-and-so? What have you done with so-and-so? And so because you tended not to move people that were doing damn well in their job. You hated like hell to move them into a job for which they were either trying just to give them more experience. So it was very useful to have these guys come around and gig you about the moves that you ought to make. And it was a useful function of the DuPont company. Had guys, by the way, these guys that were the employer relations guys had tended to be plant managers. They knew all of the ins and outs. They knew why you didn't want to do it. They were very knowledgeable guys. So in a low-key way, they'd gig you. And it worked. It worked.
Now, at this point, you're moving away from production, you're moving away from research in terms of being directly involved.
Yeah.
Now you're becoming more of a manager.
Oh, yeah. Well,
how did you feel about that?
Well, I got to tell you a story. I was going to tell this to Lisa because she was the speaker from Exxon. And she pointed out that most researchers want to continue to do research. Well, I was a researcher. I went into production, but really I liked research. And the way I learned to be a manager, became a manager, was when I was in the ADN plant, I was technical superintendent. Then I became production supervisor, back to technical superintendent. Well, when I was back to technical superintendent, I realized that, God, I got to sell this guy on my ideas, and if I fail, he's going to do what the hell he wants. That's when I decided that it was better to be a manager and worry about people problems than to be a technical guy. And that probably in 1951 or two is when I made up my mind that was the real route for me. And that's when I ceased to be a technical guy.
Now, 2 years after you were 2 years later, in 1956, you moved to the sales department.
Yeah.
This must have been quite a new experience for you.
Quite new. I knew nothing about it. But again, the electrochemicals at that time had a director of sales and two assistant directors, and I was one of two. And the guy that taught me a hell of a lot about sales was the other assistant. A guy that just died, a guy named Eddie McGovern, who went to Lehigh. He graduated in 1929. And I'll never forget the story he told me. He used to tell me it took him till 1937 to get back to his starting salary. There were two 10% cuts somewhere. But he taught me a hell of a lot about sales at that point in time. And I've got to tell you this story about how you think you got moved. We had to write an annual report on sales goals, how we did, and apparently the guy was then the assistant general manager. He finally became the president of DuPont. A guy named C.B. McCoy, Charles Belford McCoy. He didn't like the report, so I got this job of rewriting the whole damn thing, and it was obviously it must have been accepted. And I think that this is where I go back to the training I got years earlier from a guy who said, "God, be bright, be brief, be off," because I wasn't in sales long enough to really learn a whole hell of a lot about them. But I became assistant general manager because in 1958 DuPont decided to elevate the international department, which was an auxiliary department, and they named the guy, the head of it, was the son of Walter Carpenter, who had been president of the company, Sam Carpenter. He was yanked away. I don't think he'd been in Elkem for 9 months, so the management had to figure out, who the hell are we going to make assistant general manager? I'm hoping that the reason that came about was probably because of my writing skills. Don't know that.
What kinds of responsibilities did you have in the sales department?
In the sales department, I was responsible for more along the lines of the technical end. We had, I think, and this is an interesting process, about that time DuPont built what they called Chestnut Run, which was a research laboratory for sales. And God, we couldn't get anybody to go there because all the research chemists said, God, that's the end of the road. It took, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years to really staff that, guys, with people that we thought would be good, because they said, God, these programs are negligible. So the other assistant director of sales had the straight marketing. He had the district offices reporting to him. But again, he was a very influential guy in me learning, because those lines were not as rigid as, and I got to know customers, I got to know the district managers, and we made a lot of calls together, because how the hell do you learn a part of the business you know nothing about? And one of the things I learned about sales is that it's damn hard to predict what is going to happen in sales. That was quite different from R&D or from manufacturing, where you were dealing with more finite extrapolations. In sales, to this day, I don't believe sales work yet, because basically you're trying to predict what your customer's going to do. And he doesn't know what he's going to do, so how can he tell you what he's going to do? It's the most uncertain part of the world. Industrial world, it was then, it still is today. And I read the Wall Street Journal about every day, and I say, God, when somebody says I'm going to forecast what I'm going to do next year, I say, I don't believe it.
You moved up then to being the assistant general manager in 1958.
Yeah.
And who were you reporting to then?
I was reporting to Don Notman, who was the guy that had been plant manager at Niagara Falls. I don't recall. He was a bright guy. He was a Queen's Scholar in Canada. He went to, I think he went to Queen's. Bright guy. but not bright enough that when I was in Washington, I got a letter from Don Nauman, who by then was retired, living in Tucson, and he was a smoker all his life. And his letter said to me, I've got a cigarette dangling out of one side of my mouth and an oxygen tube. And he knew. Now, here's one of the brightest guys I've ever known, but you know, the damn smoking was so addictive he couldn't quit. And he died, I don't know, a few months later.
What kind of responsibilities did you have then?
Well, again, I ran the staff meetings. I had total responsibility. This is a case where the general manager sort of sat and watched you while you learned. And it's a tough process. Matter of fact, I probably got as nervous and unsettled for a year or two because the learning process was intense. You had to learn it at a great rate because I was 41 years old. Practically all the guys that reported to me were a hell of a lot older than I was. And yeah, so you're worried about being the young guy on the block and still telling these guys what to do. But it was an interesting process. And then Don Nauman retired, and the guy that took his place that I worked for about 6 or 7 years, a guy named Jack Clark. He was a PhD chemist from Cornell. His family had founded Clark Equipment Company in Michigan someplace. And he was a director of Clark Equipment. He was also a trustee of Cornell. He maintained very close contacts with his university, and he was a bright guy. He'd come out of the photo products department to become head of Elkem. I worked for him for about 6 or 7 years. An interesting guy. He threw one of the best parties I've ever been to in Wilmington or anywhere for his 35th wedding anniversary in the Gold Ballroom. You ever been to the Gold Ballroom in Wilmington?
No.
Well, it's in the Hotel DuPont. He had Victor Borga as one of the entertainers that night.
Wow.
And he didn't want any toast during after the party, he told his wife, this is it. I'm getting a divorce after 35 years of marriage. And he came to me the following morning, because I was his assistant, Sunday morning, said, I just told my wife that this is the end of the road. And it also goes to show you how little you know about what the hell's going on in the office. Because the gal that he married was a gal named Ruth. I forget her. What the hell? But that romance must have been going on for a few months. God, within 20 feet of us, and I knew nothing about it. But he married that gal, then divorced her and married a doctor, and then he committed suicide.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know. But he was a knowledgeable guy, smart as a whip, and I learned a hell of a lot from Jack Clark. But the responsibility was running everything. The general manager sat by, and his job was to see that you didn't make any mistakes.
And you continued in that, looks like, about 8 years.
Yeah, I did. I did. Well, I've learned subsequently that the guy who was then, I think, the chairman of the company thought I was too young. There have only been three guys that made assistant general managers that were 41. And two of them became chairman of the company. Brel McCoy was one, and Dick Heckert was the other guy. And this guy said, this guy's too young. What the hell is he going to do next? And he's probably right.
Well, you did make a change in 1966 then.
Yeah, in 1966 I went to the explosives department, and I was the first guy, non-explosives guy, ever become a general management. And the reason the executive committee, which we had in those days, felt that the explosives department was wrong in a lot of different directions, and they figured the only guy that could change it is some new guy that would look at fresh. And I'll never forget, I was told that explosives were going to have their first sales meeting out at the Broadmoor in Colorado Springs before I became aboard, about a week or two before. So I went out to that meeting to meet all the sales guys, and I sat in on a technical session, and there was some guy talking about AMFO, this, AMFO. God, I put up my hand. I said, "What is AMFO?" And God, I never got an answer, because the AMFO was ammonium nitrate fuel oil mixture, which had taken 85% of the time of my business in the previous 10 years. They figured, this guy's going to be our I've never forgotten that story.
That's a great introduction to your new group, isn't it?
Oh, God. But, you know, that was an interesting job, because DuPont made two textile fibers intermediate. We made acrylonitrile by a DuPont process, which was, it stunk. It was terrible. Way behind the power curve. So I had to go hat in hand to Sohio, who owned the process for making acrylonitrile, and get a license, and that was tough doing. And then also we had a process for making dimethyl terephthalate using nitric acid for the oxidation of paraxylene, and that stuck. We used to blow up a condenser that was, I don't know, 30 feet tall about once a month, right? And here these guys were experts on nitric acid, but they shrouded the damn thing so it blew up. Didn't kill anybody. This is how I, in some respects, got acquainted with Ralph Landau, because he tried to sell his technology for making terephthalic acid. Couldn't sell it to DuPont, who should have bought it. Couldn't sell it to ICI, who said, we're about to invent it, the process. So he sold the whole thing lock, stock, and barrel to Amoco. So I had to go to Amoco, hat in hand, trying to get a license to build their process, and they wouldn't give me a license. Well, finally, we got a license by agreeing to buy a hell of a lot of dimethyl terephthalate from, I forget how long, probably 5 or 6 or 7 years, and then they broke down and gave us a license. But that was hard to do, and if you were an insider, you would have had a tough time doing that, because you would have had the whole damn organization against you, believing that, God, you're going to bring new technology. And matter of fact, we did one other thing that was unusual in DuPont in those days. We got Badger to build the acrylonitrile plant, because they had built, I don't know, 15 of them around the world. They knew how to do it. And the engineering department, who was a powerful organization those days, God, they finally succumbed. But it took some real doing to get these guys to build that plant, which they did, by the way. Safety was preeminent, and it started up like a charm. It was a good operation.
Well, there are a couple of things I'm curious about. One is, why are these intermediates being made within something called the explosives department?
Well,
or is this historical?
It is historical, yeah. In other words, DuPont was sort of, DuPont had a lot of internal competition for a hell of a long time. Probably up until maybe 10 years ago, there was a lot of internal competition. So you followed the inventions, and no matter where the hell the inventions were made, then that... And by the way, DuPont rarely turned down a project. Rarely. Because, again, the profits were so high that the X Committee practically said yes to almost everything. And there was no serious attempt to set priorities in the company until maybe 10 years ago. So the net result is that intermediates could show up anywhere. It all depended on where the invention was made or who got a license to a process. So explosives made acrylonitrile. And by the way, Elkem made acrylonitrile, too. We had a plant in Memphis, Tennessee that made it from acetylene and HCN. We made HCN. Acrylonitrile, the new process, made HCN as a byproduct, which was sort of interesting because we were not the only users and producers of acrylonitrile via this Ohio process, and HCN was a co-product. We were the only ones that would sell HCN in tank cars. Monsanto made it, American Santa made it. They wouldn't, because they were worried about shipping HCN by tank car. And to far as I know to this day, DuPont is still shipping HCN by tank car. But those tank cars were built, God, you could turn them upside down. You could crush them. They wouldn't break because the walls were extraordinarily thick. We only had one incident where there was a lead rupture release valve, and apparently there was a fire, timber or something, and that melted. But as you know, HCN will burn, so nobody was hurt or killed. But those cars were rugged. But little by little, if I have kept track of that, but most of the HCN is right next to the consumption. I don't know how much HCN is being shipped by rail anymore. Just don't know.
Another question I had was the reluctance that you experienced to new technology. Was that an isolated occurrence within DuPont, or do you think it was a common occurrence in DuPont?
Well, what do you mean by that question?
Well, you had to go out and get new technology because the old processes were outdated.
Well, that's what I'd call it. You've heard this before, the NIH factor. Matter of fact, that's why Ralph Landau had to sell his technology, which he had, he developed, because ICI thought they were right on the verge of developing technology. DuPont probably thought it had a better process, and Ralph Landau's guys really ran it to the laboratory scale. So somebody had to spend a lot of money to put it through, and you get the NIH factor comes into play. Probably more often than it ever should.